Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question today, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. You will be prompted to record your first and last name. The conference is being recorded. If you have any objection, you may disconnect at this time. Now I will turn the call over to your host, Mr. Chris Hoadley. Thank you. You may begin.
Hi, and welcome. Thanks to everybody for being here, whether in person or virtually. I am happy to announce our last cyber learning lecture of the fiscal 2015 year. Dr. Chris Lund is here from France, and it is a bit of an unusual talk for us. The Cyber Learning and Future Learning Technologies Program, as most of you in the room know, is a research program at NSF that was jointly launched by a number of NSF directorates to study and develop new genres of learning technology. So typically our speaker series involves people who are researchers talking about new genres of learning technologies that they've developed or have been studying. However, in this case, we're going a little meta. And so while Chris could talk about learning technologies she's developed in the past, either in her role as a scientist or as an entrepreneur, today she's going to be talking about research they've been doing in France on studying the scientific community that does research in education and learning. And I will let her expound on that a bit as she gets into the details. Chris Lund is a senior researcher with the, and apologies in advance for my French pronunciation, the Centre de Recherche Nationale Scientifique of France. She's housed at the Université de Lyon in the École Normale Supérieure, so in the education university within Lyon's university system. And she is cross-trained in both cognitive science and computer science. She's an AI specialist. Her work crosses linguistics, psychology, computer science. And here today she's going to be talking about the collective knowledge bases of educational research, so doing bibliometric and scientometric analyses of the who and the what of education research. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Chris Lund. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. So I would just like to thank Chris Hoadley for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here. I'm looking forward to getting your feedback on this work that will focus on revealing the collective knowledge bases of educational research by scientific analysis. And I think I'm thinking that there might be different reasons why you came to listen to this talk. One might be that you're interested in the content and you might want to know about what I can say about education research. The second might be that you are interested in the scientometric method for other applications. And the third may be the repercussions of policy that can come from this type of study. And finally, the fourth, I think, will have to do with people that are interested in interdisciplinary context, because I'll be talking a bit about that as well in regards to research and education. So this is a work in progress, and it began a couple of years ago and then continued with the research, Hae-san Jung from Hallam University in South Korea spent a six-month sabbatical period at my laboratory, and she will be first author on a paper that, one of the first papers that we're working on, and this work is then also done in collaboration with the two guys here, Sebastian Grosjean, who did his PhD with Pablo Jensen, and they both work at the Institute of Complexity, and they're the experts on the methodology. So I won't necessarily be able to answer questions in detail concerning the method, but I'll be able to give you a flow chart type of explanation of what we did. So if you have any questions and if you want to hire Sebastian, who is coming out onto the market, if you want to look at scientometric analyses in different contexts, then please talk to me. So the overview of the talk will be as follows. I'll discuss a bit about the diversity of research in education, present these knowledge bases that we found, talk about how we think they're relevant to communities of practice, and also talk about how we think research in education fits into the larger human and social sciences as based upon the work we've done here. And then finally, I'd like to get some of your feedback about how we can use these interactive maps that map this research space on education. We're going to be releasing those maps soon to the world. So first of all, I'd like to start with a bit of an anecdote. In Lyon and the Saint-Étienne area, I've been tasked with organizing research along with a couple colleagues, André Robert and Daniel Simon. We're supposed to organize all of the research having to do with cognition, education, and language in that area. And so this is in preparation to asking the French government for a large grant, and we're in competition with a bunch of other French cities. And so because of my background in cognitive science and the work I do in linguistics and psychology, I have a biased view. None of you maybe have a biased view on what research is in these fields. And so it was interesting because we're working on getting a workshop going, and we want to, foster research on the frontiers between cognition, education, and language. And so André said, well, I know somebody from Canada who works at the frontier of education and cognition. And I had to bite my tongue, and I didn't quite bite it fast enough, because what I said was that, well, it always has to do with cognition, right, if it has to do with education, because it's learning and teaching. And so, but no, that's not the case, right? As you can see on the left, sure, if you have psychological principles of learning, if you have the neural bases of learning or the relationship between learning and teaching according to a particular discipline of study like chemistry or physics, yes, it's got to do with cognition. But it can also do research in education that deals with the history of educational institutions, that deals with the governmental influence on policymaking in education. And here we're not talking about cognition per se in the ways of, you know, learning and teaching. And so this is just an initial point that I want to make, that research in education is very diverse, and so what are we going to do with that? We wanted to get a handle on that with this global view that we're trying to get. And so I also wanted to say that then I think that this illustrates also that research in education, and probably all research, is really a socially constructed type of thing. And so, like, we're doing this social construction of research in Lyon around education, language, and cognition. That's what you're doing here, I would dare to say, at NSF as well, socially constructing the landscape on a, you know, of course, a larger scale in the United States. So what is our angle? We want to look at research as collective knowledge construction. And so how does the individual knowledge construction get integrated into the collective? One thing that really, an experience that motivated me was the writing, the co-editing of this book with some colleagues. It came out in the computer-supported collaborative learning series that Chris co-edits, Productive Multivocality in the Analysis of Group Interactions. So here we shared databases. We shared corpora of group interactions. We had people doing analyses coming from different frameworks with different methods. And so we looked to the extent to which we could combine and integrate these methods, or was it better that they be left in productive tension? So this is kind of the thing that we're also looking at, and that motivated me to look more generally at the research in education. And so we want to, we say then, well, what connects researchers who are highly distributed over space and time? Well, publications represent a kind of a crystallized knowledge that is preserved from past meaning-making practices that groups may have. And so given that then, well, scientometrics is one way to help understand how science is organized. And so we were inspired by two different processes. The first were our colleagues in complex systems. They had already used these techniques to map scientific institutions, to map the field of complex systems, and now here we're mapping the field of research and education. They also mapped, they assessed the interdisciplinarity of the CNRS, and that was several hundred French laboratories. And so that was also very interesting. And I just want to briefly mention some of the work that has been done in the field of education. So Chris Hoadley and colleagues looked at the relationship between learning sciences and instructional system design. And some other people looked at the growth of the field of CSCL and the emergent thematic structure. And so we were inspired by these different this different work already in Scientometrics. Like I said, we wanted to bring it up to a more global view of research in education. And so we needed to get a database. And instead of taking the Web of Science, which is probably the most well-known type of database, we went with Scopus because it's got a slightly wider coverage of non-English publications. And if we look at the publications from 1980 to 2015, we see that there was a huge increase in journals that either, you know, came on, were created, or were covered by Scopus. And so then we decided, well, there's something going on there. What we're going to do is look what happens before that, from 2000 to 2004, to understand as an initial study. And then we'll look and see what happens after 2005. So how did we actually get our two corpora then? So we have a corpus in education, and we have a corpus in social sciences. And Scopus is divided up into four different topics. The categories, life sciences, physical sciences, health, and then social and human sciences, humanities. In that, there are 27 different subject areas. But strangely enough, there's no education label. And so what we did, well, we're in France, and so we took the agency that evaluates all the French laboratories and universities, and they had a list of about 500 journals that are labeled as education journals. And this is a list based on ERCI, which is the European Educational Research Quality Indicator. And so that gave us almost 37,000 publications to look at. And when we take the social sciences category in Scopus, we get 123,000 publications to look at. So that's our corpus. Briefly, the Scopus subject areas that the education corpus touches, mostly social sciences, you can see the percentage and the record count, psychology and medicine as well, and then the percentages drop quite a bit, but you can see a bit of STEM influence. What are the journals that contribute most to the education corpus? We've also got some STEM influence. Chemistry is the top journal, chemical education, medical education. Then we've got educational leadership. Quite similar numbers then in child development. Phi Delta Kappa is a professional magazine that deals with K through 12 research and policy. And then teaching, medical teaching, engineering, you can see on the right then, a lot of both psychology and STEM type themes. So for each publication then, I gave you the numbers before, we went in and we took from Scopus the author, the name of the publication source, the year, the title, the keywords given by either the author or Scopus, and then we looked at the references of each of those publications, okay? And so the author, the year of publication, and the title of reference. And so why did we look at the references? Well, this is the focus of our scientometric method. We used bibliographic coupling as opposed to co-citation. So what happens in bibliographic coupling on the left is that you have two papers, and then you look at the reference section in the paper, and then you see, well, who do they cite? Who are those authors citing? And if they cite two references that are the same two references, then we cluster them together. And that's opposed to a co-citation way of doing scientometric analysis where you associate papers because they're both cited by other papers. Okay, so if we go with bibliographic coupling, which is what we did, that creates a network using papers as nodes and their common references as links. And we think that it's a bit more representative. It gives equal weight to all published articles, regardless of citation histories. So the method per se, then, the way we do what we call a cluster detection, like how do we put those papers together then, is with an algorithm called the Louvain algorithm, and it has to do with modularity maximization. And so you can see kind of the process from the left to the right in the cluster detection. Publications need to share at least two references, like I said. Publications in the same cluster do not have to be linked directly. So you can see, for example, up on the top, the green, like one is paper one is connected to paper three. Paper three is connected to paper four, but one and four are not connected. So that means they don't share references, but they're similar. They're still in the same cluster. Now, there's something that will be of an interest also later. Publications in different clusters may share references, but only a few. So those are the links between, like, say, the green, the red, and the purple, and the blue. There are still links between clusters because they're all in education, and we're going to look at that in detail after. Clusters vary in size and cohesiveness. So the size of the node is, like, how many papers are in the cluster, and I'll tell you what cohesiveness is in a bit. So here we go, and I guess, okay, it went away, so you can see the title. We got 18 clusters. Now, that's also because we limited to 400 papers. If we had gone down, we would have had more clusters, but we did that limit. And so here you can see, I don't know if you can mean developmental disabilities, child cognitive development, educational equality, math education, science of learning, motivation, science education, measurement, language teaching methods, et cetera. So we're asking, well, are these subfields of education? Are they topics? What are they? So a lot of the work we've done is in trying to figure out, well, how can we, you know, give meaning to these clusters now that we've been able to locate. So what we did, one of the things we did is we looked at the top 15 core references of the clusters. And so I've taken the science of learning cluster here. And so you can see the top, we've got a list of the references. I've got the frequency, so that's how frequently a reference appears in the particular cluster. And I've also got the sigma, which indicates how unique or significant that reference is for that particular cluster. And Lave and Wenger, situated learning, legitimate peripheral participation. Vygotsky, mind in society. We've got Brown, which is the situated cognition in the culture of learning reference, and also Wenger, communities of practice. A lot of sociocultural, social cognition types of theoretical references. They're really all theoretical here. And so we'll have a little bit of something to say about that later. In comparison, if we look at the measurement cluster, probably not surprisingly, the references are method-based. So we've got Wilkinson, and this was Statistical Methods in Psychology, Journals, Guidelines, and Explanations. Sometimes we don't have the title for different syntactical reasons. Applications of Item Response, the standards for educational and psychological testing come from the New London Group, so that's a group of people. That's also why it's not appearing. And so you can see, you know, educational psychological measurement, a lot of psychology of statistical and methods types of references. So in other clusters, then, these are kind of like two extremes, you know, theory and then method. A lot of the other clusters are a mix of theoretical, method, empirical domain, and what we call consensus documents. And that's quite interesting. So they'll be, like, say, curriculum standards or assessment, ways to assess mathematics learning in the classroom or something. And so this it's interesting because those documents are important for education, and that's not surprising, really, because research in education, there are different stakeholders that have different criteria and different things that are important to them, and so they have to agree. And so research in education is driven, actually, by those types of documents, and this is contrary to, say, like, particle physics. which doesn't rely on these type of consensus documents. So now there's another way to look at, to characterize these clusters. And so we found out that, so with our complexity science colleagues, we developed a bunch of different methods. So we always say, okay, what do we want to know? How can we do it? And so there's this, the W value. If we've got a high W value, then that means that the cluster shares more references with other clusters that have low W values. And so here, if we take the top five, we've got science of learning, motivation, science education, math education, and teacher training. And it happens that these clusters also are homogeneously interlinked inside of them. So that they most articles share similar core references. We can compare that then to the heterogeneously and loosely connected clusters, and those have these low W values, and we think they have more specialized references. And these are measurement, higher education, cooperative learning, child behavioral development, and language teaching methods. Now, remember, this is a snapshot in time from 2000 to 2004, and this it can be, you know, and will be evolving, of course. I'll give you a visualization of this so that you'll get a better understanding of it. But the high values of this QI correspond to heterogeneous clusters. That means that they have a distinguishable inner structure in the cluster. So what that means then is that there's like a juxtaposition of loosely connected kind of subclusters. So there'll be like maybe subtopics going on in that cluster. Some of those subtopics will be connected to education-related issues, but some won't. So in order to get a handle on that, what I did is I went in and did some qualitative analyses, all of us on the paper. And so if we take, for example, the child cognitive development cluster. We'll have subclusters on measurement or on age-related types of issues. And in the measurement subcluster, we can find a paper that deals with validity theory. Now, you might say, well, what's that got to do with education? Well, of course, it could have an application to measurement of child cognitive development in educational context. But it's not educational per se, right? In the same way, language teaching methods can have a work on vocabulary, work on acquisition. In a linguistics and technology type subfield, I found a paper that looked at how syntactic complexity varied depending if you were in synchronous or asynchronous communication. And so that isn't education per se either. But you can imagine that if you are teaching a language, and you're looking at syntactic complexity, you want to develop maybe syntactic complexity, it's going to make a difference if you're in a asynchronous or synchronous kind of learning situation. In the same way, sociology of education, they can look at globalization or colonialism types of subfields. I found a paper in the, or Pablo found this one in policy, where the researchers were rethinking the concept of trust in a performative culture and applying that to the case of education. So then it's more of an application to an educational context. And maybe that's the way that we can qualify how these clusters that aren't principally focused on education but still in a peripheral way work on education-related issues. This is for the moment how we're understanding this, but it's evolving. So if we look at this in a visual way, the science of learning clusters on the left and the sociology of education on the right, and each node here is an article, and you can see that the science of learning cluster has homogeneous connections between articles, and so this means that they have the references are kind of more shared. And on the right-hand side, the sociology of education cluster has heterogeneous connections, and you can see how they cluster within that, and so that shows that they're working maybe on different subfields then with maybe relevant references then that are split. So that was then the clusters per se, if we looked at them individually. If we now jump back up a bit and we look at the education corpus, there are top 20 references that are cited in the education corpus. And here we see Vygotsky again, and we see Levin Wenger, and we see a consensus document by the National Research Council on national science education standards. And we've got some method naturalistic inquiry by Lincoln, a few Bandura articles also on social types of theoretical approaches. And I'm going to contrast this top 20 most cited references across all of the education corpus with what I'm going to call networking references. These two are here. It's Adams in the only and most cited beginning to read, and in the most cited Journal of Educational Psychology, an article by Ames. So, oops, I guess that doesn't work. This one works. This is the most networking, and the most networking is what is the glue. So remember I said that these are the clusters that you see here, but then they're glued together in one way or another, and they make up the whole education corpus. And the glue are these networking references. And the networking force of a reference is the sum over all pairs of clusters of the proportion of their links explained by that reference. And so there's a lot of overlap between the most cited and the most networking. But there are some that are just in the most networking. So, for example, Glaser's grounded theory, qualitative evaluation by Patton, and a feminine approach to ethics and moral education we find also in the most networking. So this is what glues the network together, really, in the education corpus. Pablo, who is in physics, sent me, just like yesterday, I think, some more analysis that he had done. And this may enable us to see the potential importance of the science of learning cluster within this research and education. And so it so happens that in this education research corpus, right, made up of these 18 clusters, the most cited and the most networking, gluing, greatly overlap, which is what we saw. You know, I pointed out when they were just in or cited or networking. And only two references overlap for condensed matter physics in the most cited and the most networking. So what does that mean? In fact, if we look at those references, the top 20 cited and the top 20 most networking, they're actually all in the science of learning cluster. And they're all which is the theoretically based. So can we therefore say that the theoretical science of learning references glue the space of research and education together, in addition to those methodological references? For example, Vygotsky is cited 230 times outside of the science of learning cluster out of a total of 800 citations, but in the core references of theoreticians in physics, on the other hand, are almost ignored outside of the physics theory cluster. There are only 8 citations out of 280. So this is also relevant to this discussion that Pablo and I have been having. I call it the fragmentation debate, Pablo versus Chris. I said that research in education is more fragmented, and he said, no, research in physics is more fragmented. And so we can argue about what fragmentation is, but I was thinking that our disciplinary glasses blind us in some ways. And so, but given this, if Vygotsky on the one hand and Levin Wenger on the other are cited all throughout the education corpus, whereas there are no equivalent references that are cited all through the physics corpus, then, well, is Pablo right? Has he won? Is physics more fragmented than education? Are these the references that unite research and education? And if this is the case, well, what is really being done in the science of learning cluster? I mean, are they building on the theory? Are they applying the theory in different situations? What's really happening? And, you know, this just came in. Like I said, I got an email just a couple, maybe the day before yesterday. Pablo also might be a victim of confirmation bias, though, because he wants research in physics to be more fragmented, right, than education. So we'll see. The next thing we did is that we wanted to, one of the ways we thought that we could evaluate or understand the clusters is to relate them to communities of practice. And so we took the American Educational Research Association. It's one of the biggest and oldest professional organizations of research, 12 divisions, 155 special interest groups. And we couldn't find data online for membership, but we could find the 2005 meeting. We had 10,000 researchers in 2,000 sessions, so we were able to get those names, and we wanted to, you know, match the authors and the presenters together and see if it made sense. So it is just 1 year of conference data versus 4 years of publication data, but it's a start. And so we looked at the divisions and SIGs with more than 10 cluster authors, and it turns out that 23% of AERA division presenters published in a cluster, 24% of SIG presenters published in a cluster, and 10% of cluster authors presented at AERA in 2005 in the other direction. So if we have a visual of that, it looks like this. It's a correspondence analysis factor map. And we the clusters are in red and the divisions and SIGs are in blue. And there are some meaningful matches of clusters and topics of divisions and SIGs. So that means that more often than chance, we've got quite a bit the same authors, okay? For example, measurement, both the cluster and the division, the motivation cluster, the motivation SIG, child behavioral development cluster and the child SIG, and teacher training cluster and the teacher education division. And we've also got, that's what these round circles signify, is that some clusters and divisions also have high residuals, which mean that they share a lot more authors than could be shared by chance. And so we've got science and math and advanced technology learning type clusters that also share. And also I think down here this was higher education that shared as well many authors. So that was then the to what extent do these clusters represent communities? Then we were interested in where is education in the social sciences more largely. And so this is a map of the social science space. I said that we had 123,000 articles are the ones that actually map together. So we use the Scopus social sciences category. Again, the area of note is the size of the number of articles in the cluster, and it's the color corresponds to discipline, but here the labels were automatically generated. I think I forgot to say that for the other clusters, it's the most common title keyword. So sometimes you might get things like, I don't know, well, human, or which isn't very discriminatory. But to get the labels for the 18 clusters in the education corpus, we looked at the most frequent and the most significant title word and keyword, but also we looked at the references to really understand what was going on in that cluster. And then we oftentimes changed the label. Here, the labels are completely automatically generated, okay, from the data. And so then you can see I went in and I labeled what disciplines the colors corresponded to in terms of the category of Scopus. So we've got cognitive psychology on the right, regular psychology on the left, both green and pink areas, business and management, yellow, social science and sociology on the right, and on the bottom, economics and finance. And so the question was, well, where is education? How can we find education in this map? And so you might think, well, is education a well-defined single region with clear boundaries with other disciplines? And then the image I chose to represent that question, you might understand what I feel about that, where I've got Springfield Avenue crossing with Springfield Avenue. Doesn't seem so clear. So I'm going to go with the second type of idea that research in education is distributed over different regions. And this points to a loosely connected field with multiple knowledge bases that connect to different subfields of social sciences. And so what we did in order to test that is that we took that map that I showed you of all the social sciences, and we generated what we called an education heat map. They're physicists, you know, so they're with temperature, and we've got the more red it is, the higher proportion of articles in each cluster are also in the education corpus, okay? And the closer that the color is to blue, the lower percentage those are the papers are in the education corpus. So here we found four subfields, if we can call them subfields, that have more than 50% of their papers published in education journals: mathematics, science, learning, and education. Again, these are the labels that have been generated automatically. And then we've got subfields that have 30% of papers published in education journals: cognitive psychology, psychology, and sociology. And again, those labels are not really discriminatory, so we need to go in there and look a bit more in detail. But what you do see is that, in effect, education, research in education is closely, I mean, is has multiple interfaces and is connected to multiple disciplines in the human and social sciences. Compare that to economics on the bottom here, blue, off by itself, not connected to other disciplines. Although that's not completely fair, because then what we did is we wanted to look more deeply into this idea of disciplinary and interdisciplinary. So we developed this measure, the multidisciplinary M index, where we wanted to look at the disciplinary composition of these different social science disciplines. And so here we've got the question then we wanted to ask is that, do the clusters, if they're subfields, gather articles from different disciplines or not? And here, if we look at education on the left, education articles belong to clusters that contain, okay, you can see blue, a third percent of education articles, makes sense, but also a third of psychology articles, which are in gray, and then 13% of articles belonging to medicine in green. This is a bit similar to decision theory cluster on the very right, where you can see articles belonging to economics, also to business, and a bit to decision theory. Economics, on the other hand, is in orange, is really belonging to economics and also to business, a quite close field. So maybe we could say it's less interdisciplinary, but maybe that will also be contested if we spoke to an economist. But from this view, this is what it gives. So in summary then, what we did was a scientometrics analysis of education articles from the period of 2000-2004 using the Scopus database. We gave a map of global education research that consists of 18 research clusters. We're not sure if we want to call them subfields or topics or what yet. Some clusters share a majority of theory-based references. Others a majority of methodological-type references, and still others kind of a mixture. Clusters differ in terms of their connectivity to other clusters. We have this homogeneous, highly connected versus heterogeneous, loosely connected idea. On the other hand, there's this glue that connects all the education clusters together. There are some close matches between AERA divisions and SIGs and the clusters, so maybe that there's some validity of thinking that they do represent professional communities. And we think we've also demonstrated that research education is multidisciplinary. Not that we didn't know that, maybe, but making close connections to other fields, more so than, say, psychology and economics. And if I could just briefly go through the different things that we could potentially discuss together, I think we can maybe talk more about the science of learning cluster, what we can say about that. Again, maybe the limits of the representation of whether these clusters mirror communities or not, how research in education advances simultaneously in different areas, and what we can say about these highly connected clusters, which are the science of learning, motivation, science education, math education, and teacher training. Again, we see some kind of STEM influence. And to what extent is this socially constructed, maybe by NSF and funding opportunities? do they play a central role in organizing and giving coherence to educational research as a whole? And finally, does it make sense to further attempt to kind of define the inside and the outside of research in education? And I'll give you a preview of our interactive mapping system. I'll be ending with this, and then we can go to questions. So here we have different ways that you can search. We have, this is the topic level, and then we can branch out to the subtopic level. We can, colors can represent different things like topics or countries or institutions, or labels also can be generated automatically according to different criteria. And for each of these clusters, then, when you click on it, on the right-hand side, you get a most frequent list of most frequent keywords, title words, subject categories, most frequently published in journals, institutions, et cetera, most cited authors and papers. And so this has allowed us then to delve qualitatively into and enhance the quantitative results that we obtained. So now I'd like to thank you for listening, and I'm really hoping to get some good discussion going, get feedback from you. Thank you very much. Okay, so we will take online questions first, if there are any.
Thank you. For those online, let me remind you that if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. Unmute your phone and record your name when you are prompted. If you decide to withdraw your question after you're in the queue, please press star 2. Once again, press star 1 and record your name. Thank you.
Because now we wait and we don't, like, try and get in a question open. No. Okay.
So far, we have no one queued up.
Okay. So are you going to our manager, should I? Britt, I see, has a question.
Okay. I think this should make it so everyone can hear me. So I really enjoyed this. This is really thought-provoking and in many interdisciplinary ways, I think it has amazing potential. One thing that came to mind to me when you were talking about the heat maps was whether or not you had looked at making color coding in the heat map based on the average date of publication in the networks, and that could maybe give you an idea of where the growth is in certain clusters.
That is a really great suggestion, and no, we haven't done that yet because one of the problems with this is that we, in the beginning, we had probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 papers that we just saw immediately that we wanted to do. And so we're getting out this first paper now, which is really just going to be the initial landscaping of research and education, and then we have a lot of ideas of what's coming next. And thank you for that suggestion because it's very interesting, because one of the things that we think that this can allow us to do is map out emerging new themes of research. And also, I'm not sure how we could do it, but I'd also like to maybe check what in French you call a dead angle, like angle mort, like somewhere where it's not where you should be doing research, but it's not happening. And is there a way we can pinpoint that kind of a thing as well? So thank you for the suggestion. This has a question back there.
Hi. The work is fascinating, and I'm actually involved in a group that's been doing work very complementary on it. We're looking at interactions between the cognitive science literatures and the education literatures, and some of the differences are quite interesting. It really is complementary. We're looking at from 1994 to 2014, looking particularly at the years between 2000 and 2004, because there are a number of reasons to think that kind of what was happening in the air, that there's going to be a special convergence around that. And it's very interesting that you've got a grain size that we're not looking at. We're also looking at Web of Science. But just one little comment. I think we can give you something that might allow you to weigh in on your debate with Pablo. My main colleague is Alan Porter, if you know him, at Georgia Tech, who does a lot of this work. And he has derived a metric to talk about how cohesive or fragmented a particular literature is. And I can give you the formulas and references if you'd like. One other little thing that, again, I think you gave a good sense of the of how this is really a mix between empirically driven work and the necessity of making certain subjective judgments and just trying to make those explicit. One of them, again, you're clear about, you know, is there such a thing as education, or you see it spread. Psychology would be the same thing. And I think one of the dangers when you see a lot of work in psychology like this is you had it spread a bit, but you can see, for example, clinical psychology and the more cognitive ends are very different. And I actually have a degree in psychology. I know nothing about people's problems, my own, of course. But it's very, very broad. Another interesting area in there is educational psychology, which is often very different. They're clumped together, same societies. This is a different field. So you highlighted the notion of what are we talking about here? What's going on? Are these communities are interacting? Are there literatures being read by the same people? Very often not.
Yes, agreed completely. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, just a comment first and then perhaps a suggestion. The comment is that the two most highly cited papers are both basically sociology papers. Leib Wenger is Leib's sociologist, and so is Vygotsky. And I'd also like
that's arguable.
Well, he was sociologist.
Psychologist.
He's a psychologist, sociologist, because in Soviet Union he was viewed as a sociologist. Talking about work as opposed to education, actually. Anyhow, be that as it may, be calm a psychologist or a sociologist. The other thing is I think as time goes on, you picked an interesting time to for your study, but I think if the study was 10 years later, you would see Leib and Wenger and Vygotsky both going down on importance. An awful lot of the Leib and Wenger came from identifying communities of practice. That was kind of a big deal around 2000. Not so much a big deal now. And similarly for Vygotsky, led to kind of a theory of scaffolding, which was kind of the underpinning for interventions. That's being studied a little differently now. What the literature should look at, and I'm sure you have, is what the computer scientists have done with these kind of social networks and analysis, for example, of topics on the web. The algorithms that Google uses in order to find things of interest. Those algorithms are actually not too far off what you're using here. These are somewhat different links, but the sort of clustering analysis is quite similar. You might want to take a closer look at that to see whether you can gain some insights or some more accurate algorithms from there, or maybe even combine the web and what you're doing here with published literature. That'd be rather interesting too.
Yes, it would be great to use Google Scholar, actually, but the metadata isn't standardized enough so that we could do automatic searching on it. But, yeah, definitely. I think that's paper number 9, the one where we look and to see how a theory has evolved in the educational field. No.
The parties online are not able to hear that last question.
I'll put my mic on. I was saying that two of the co-authors of this work had published a paper in Science Metrics in which they did an analysis not only of the bibliometry or the literature as an input, but also of institutional affiliation, sort of linking people not only through who they cite or who they write about, but also through where they are and what institutions they're affiliated with, if you want to say anything
about
that.
I can make one comment about that. I'm not so familiar as I was not working with them, and this is their previous research before we joined up together, but what I think is interesting is that it's a kind of a policy or a socially structuring type of application of this scientometric research, because if you can show to what extent disciplines or laboratories are interdisciplinary, show the connections between departments in an institution or in a national organization across laboratories in different geographical organization areas, then it can really have some consequences and some and I think it could be even and that's what we're trying to use it for in Lyon in our bid for getting grant money from the government is a way of describing the dynamics and the of the research going on in Lyon and the interdisciplinary connections. And so this is a positive a spin, I guess, that you can put on a grant application is with this type of research. And I think that's one of the things that we're looking to do.
We do have a party waiting in queue online when you have a moment.
Okay, I guess we can take that question now. Thank you.
Thank you. Christo Leon, your line is open.
Hello. Hi, everybody. This is super impressive, all of the research. I'm the director of research for NGAT. And traditionally, we've been having so many problems motivating the humanities and the history department into do research. So looking at these clusters are just so really interesting because it's kind of like a roadmap of where they can go. Is there any, I don't know if you have this map or any of this information available online that we can share with professors?
Well, I think soon it will be available online. We are going to submit a paper, and with the paper we will have supplementary material and have the interactive mapping tool of the research space in education available for people to play around with. And in addition, we are inviting people. Actually, we're trying to figure out who we're going to invite from each cluster. And not each cluster, but a selection of clusters, probably the more homogeneous, highly connected, maybe less loosely connected clusters, but a representative selection of most cited authors or most cited papers to come to Lyon and to discuss about the space of research and education and to discuss where they think their research fits in and also in the larger human and social sciences. So we're hoping to start a conversation, an international conversation about this work. And so in answer to then your more specific question, yes, very soon, I guess, maybe when the article is published, this will be online.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are we back to face-to-face? Britt has another question.
Yeah, I don't mean to hog the air. This is just a quick one. So if you have, looking at this map, if you have widely separated clusters, do you personally interpret that as a dead end for interdisciplinary work, or is that maybe a place of great opportunity?
First of all, I think that it is a snapshot in time, right? It's just 2000, 2004, and it's evolving. And has evolved, right? Because this is really the past. But from my general psychological makeup, I would never say that it would be a dead end. No, I couldn't say that. But I think it's quite interesting, and I think we need to explore in more detail this idea that we were really worried about saying that a cluster is centrally focused on education or peripherally focused on education. In the beginning, we said it's a central cluster. We said the cluster's central or the cluster's peripheral. And we thought, we can't say that because that's going to be interpreted wrongly or negatively. And it's just this, springy algorithm that works so that the clusters are central visually just because they're more connected to the other ones. So if they're less connected, then they're on the side. But it doesn't mean that we can't make this kind of judgment and say this cluster is peripheral. Because I think it's quite interesting that, it's not a value judgment. I mean, if a cluster is working on other research but is also working on education, we can't badmouth it in some way, It's just our view of education. And then also we have to be very careful about our vocabulary. And so we try to say peripherally focusing instead of being on the periphery, you know, because it's really a point of view. It's like a rhetorical stance that we have to pay attention to. And I think that I think it's quite interesting, actually, and where I see the opportunity is that one side where I had language methods and child development and sociology of education, where I looked at a particular paper that seemed really peripheral, I mean, not focused specific in the sense that it wasn't focused specifically on education, but then when you thought about it, you could say, oh, wow, you know, yeah, that's really applicable to education, and this is how it would be applicable to education, to research and education. So knowing that, I think, and maybe bootstrapping that somehow could make education, research and education richer and connecting things is a possibility I see. Chris.
I'll ask a question and give a quick update. I checked Google Scholar, and there are three times as many citations to Leibniz-Wenger between 2010 and 2014 as there are between 2000 and 2004. Yeah, you have to scale by number of publications in that era, but assuming that the publication of the academic world is comparable, but
the challenge
indexed
has been
comparably
set
by Google. It's a hard question to solve. But I was going to say, actually, somewhat related to that, this issue of who gets to name what. And I think you know from some of our prior work, we were able to demonstrate how people who were participating in tightly connected research communities often held deep beliefs about the nature of those research communities that were demonstrably false. So that the people, you know, you could see clusters of people going to the same conferences and saying, oh, this conference is very much an American conference, or this conference is very much a European conference, when in fact the data, you know, didn't hold either of those to be true. So there's this blind man and the elephant problem in terms of how you make use of this kind of data. And I wondered if you could sort of say, What are some of the things that you've kind of stepped into? You talked a little bit about peripheral versus central, but other sorts of challenges as you're trying to figure out even something as simple as putting a label on one of these clusters. You know, what have been some of the you know, moments of different perspectives coming up even among your team, or how you maybe thought the field looked until you saw a certain kind of data?
Well, we did speak a bit about this before. Mm-hmm. Beforehand. It's the science of learning cluster. I mean, I have been in France now for 20 years, and I did actually most of my postgraduate education in France. And so, but I am an elected member of the board of the International Society of the Learning Sciences, and so for me. You know, I have been following this debate of the learning sciences versus the science of learning. And for me, although we could probably discuss it, the learning sciences seems to be more of a community label, a community of practice, rather than the science of learning, which could potentially be a field, possibly. But, I mean, we could probably discuss about that. But I think that is something where I wasn't really sure. And we discussed it. Haesan is Jiang is also an active member in the learning sciences community, and so we didn't really know. And in fact, the automatically generated label for that cluster was classroom. But when you go look at it, and when you look at the research, it's the research in the learning sciences, and so. But that's something where I think we also have to be careful about labeling. Is we spoke about the fact that the Science of Learning Centers funded by NSF are maybe something different and potentially not completely integrated into the learning sciences community. I'm not sure if that's something that is feasible to say or not. And then in other countries, there are also debates going on about which disciplines are doing science of learning versus the learning sciences. And so it's vocabulary is important. I think that, and we've seen, those of us who work in interdisciplinary contexts, we see that people use the same word to mean different things, and they use different words to mean the same thing. And so finding out what's going on with that is something that this kind of a work can maybe be a first step towards.
We have another questioner online.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Bina Van Mali, your line is open.
Hi. First, great talk. Really interesting stuff.
Thank you.
And my question goes back to some of the data and potential complications. So my question was this. Within clusters, were your data complicated by the reluctance of competing research groups to cite each other's work as primary references? Did you notice, like, subclusters developing in that fashion?
To reformulate, you're wondering if subclusters are influenced, if they're influenced by co-citation of colleagues in the same research lab? Is that what you're asking?
No, refusal of competing research labs to cite each other.
Oh, refusal of competitors to cite each other. I guess I can't answer that because we didn't look at that. we've just done the Louvain algorithm clusters articles automatically based on shared citations. So we didn't look, I mean, we could, but that would really take, qualitative analysis. We'd have to, have an idea of who are competing. And in what field is it happening, and then go to look at who's citing who. But one thing we did that it brings to mind, there's so many possibilities of citations in education research. I mean, once we looked at two articles that were really essentially working on the same type of thing, and they didn't share any references. I mean, it's that can happen. And yet it was a real similar topic. So I think that can complicate these types of analyses as well. Chris, yeah.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think that's one of the known weaknesses of co-citation versus bibliographic coupling, that if you are doing co-citation analysis, it is more prone to not recognizing that people who are sort of refusing to cite each other are in the same place. But
bibliographic
is a little more robust against that.
Yes. Good point. And I had said that earlier, but forgot to bring that up. Yes. Yes, another question in the back.
Again, perhaps we're in the trenches at this point, so this might be appropriate for after the talk. But one way around this this problem that you're both noting in education, a number of areas where you might seem to be in the same field, citing the same sorts of things, but not necessarily share many or any citations. Again, another grain size is to look at the journals that are being cited. So it isn't necessarily the articles, but it's the journals. Are you citing the same journals? And that says something about the kinds of things that you're citing. And so even in an area like education where two things look similar, don't share citations, I'll bet they're citing the same sorts of journals. And then, again, Loot Latest or from people like that have done matrices to see the extent to which these journals tend to cite one another anyway.
Exactly. And that you can see here that we've got the most frequently cited journals that used journals in which the articles appear in that cluster as data that's coming out. But one of the things, interestingly, also that we found is that, I said that Scopus didn't have an education category, and we've got this list of 500 education journals. Well, who decided that they were? I mean, I told you it was the European organization. But, in fact, this gives us a way to critically evaluate that list, right? and to look and see, well, who's got the power of deciding whether or not a journal should be labeled as an education journal. And we found journals that clearly should be in that list, but were not. And so this is, yeah, but off the top of my head, maybe not, but like some kind of psychology education journal, for example. I don't remember offhand exactly. I'll look it up and tell you. But so this is an interesting, I guess maybe peripheral consequence of this type of work, is that we can go and say to the people of power who are deciding what counts as an education journal, say, look, this is in a cluster that is concentrating on education in this way. Why isn't it in your list? It should be in your list.
Thanks. Thanks to our speaker, Chris Lund.
Thank you.
Great, not only jet lag, but also the Pope, to come to D.C. and as I said before, for those of us who are not virtual, if anybody would like to come to lunch with our speaker afterwards, you're welcome to join us. Thank you, everybody, for attending.
Thank you. And thank you to the organizer online. Thank you.
This will conclude today's conference. All parties may disconnect at this time.
Can we share?